mechanism to, it doesn't have to be a wheel, it could be, you know, like a ride at a an amusement fair, a long arm and, you know, module on one end and a module on the other. They could develop something like that, and maybe that will help, maybe that will be something they'll design in the future. But for the time being, there's nothing.
Yeah, Paul, I just hope some rocket scientist doesn't come up with the idea of breeding astronauts. I could imagine way too many bad science fiction movies and books where that kind of gets out of hand.
In the case of putting a fish in weightlessness, I'm guessing the fish has the equivalent of a vestibular function. I mean, we figure out which way is up by the semicircular canals in our ears, and when you're in space, you eventually learn to orient yourself optically. You put yourself right side up compared to the instrument panel you want to use and read, or to the person you're talking to. But a fish in a body of water where there is no longer, is in microgravity, there is no longer a definition of up, is a problem. On top of that, without the local gravity, any bubbles in that water are going to stay there. They don't have a chance to float to the top. So that fish swimming in weightlessness strikes me as a very problematic situation. I wonder, do they pressurize that tank a little bit to give him some local effect? How do you keep a fish happy in water, in weightlessness, or in microgravity? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
That's a good question, and as a person who owned tropical fish as a person, I never quite figured out how to make them happy. They didn't really last very long for me, although I had a short stage where I was breeding guppies. But I assume that what they did was agitate the water in order to get around the oxygen content and getting the bubbles out of suspension. But other than that, I don't know if it was pressurized. It appears to be a very sealed off experiment in some ways. So it might not have been that easy to get into and out of. They didn't really give you that much details, at least that I could find. It's just, it must not have been great fun for them either. I'm not sure if they work through the same mechanism that we do, or they have some mechanism that works in the opposite direction with something that's buoyant in their body, that they sense location of gravitational fields and such.
There's a little bit of a relationship here to the Thinking Physics book by Epstein. One of the puzzles asked in Thinking Physics is that in free space, you can put two massive objects, and by gravitational effects, Newtonian gravitational effects, they will attract each other. If you now take the inverse, if free space was not empty, but filled up with a fluid, but you had two bubbles nearby in that fluid, gravitationally speaking, would the two bubbles repel each other or attract each other? And when you go through the whole study, you find out that the two bubbles, gravitationally speaking, very slowly attract each other. That would suggest that the bubbles in the fish tank in microgravity, gravitationally, very slowly, those bubbles will attract each other and come together. Don't know if that will help. Maybe the fish can see the bubble and know to steer around it. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
I don't know. It would be interesting to find out how it affects its buoyancy, if it kind of floats as well as it usually did, or if it kind of sometimes is found swimming at right angles to the way fish are supposed to swim. I would sort of be interested in the little details about the experiment, other than the picture that life stinks if you're a fish on an ISS.
In the recent movie called Passengers, I think that's the name of it, the heroine of the movie was swimming in a pool and in this spaceship, this very long voyage spaceship, they had a way of creating artificial gravity, and she's swimming in a pool. But the gravity-generating machine failed. The water no longer was responding to gravity, and she was in that water and had great trouble breathing under those circumstances. At least they gave you a hint of some of the problems that could happen with trying to swim in a body of water in microgravity. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
In that movie Passengers, they duplicated what the astronauts do all the time. They'll show, you'll take a little bit of water, and they'll have it float around the ISS, and it floats around in a ball, you know, just one big ball, and they'll swallow it, you know. And it's very entertaining to people watching it when they're doing an interview. But they took that to the extreme. So, yeah, she was in this pool, and all of a sudden this water is weightless, and she's in the middle of it and couldn't swim out of it. And no matter how much she tried, she couldn't get out of it. Luckily, the gravitational field came back on. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, water in the absence of gravity, its surface tension causes it to form the smallest area for the volume, which is a sphere. I think one of the problems is that you're not totally buoyant, but buoyancy is a factor that everyone is used to in swimming. And if you take the gravity away, you take any hint of buoyancy away with it.
There was a recent puzzle asking the question, what is the average density of a human being? And if you Google that, you'll come up with a number, 0.985, I think it is, with normal breath. But if you breathe out as hard as you can make your average density greater than zero, greater than unity, therefore you'll sink. And what this reminds me of an incident that I saw, which scared the daylights out of me. Let me drop and describe it to you. A friend of mine has a pool in his backyard that at one end is 10 foot deep, concrete bottom pool. His 13-year-old daughter was very skilled at swimming in that pool, and I think his 13-year-old daughter probably had a BMI of 19. In other words, she was all muscle, no extra weight. And when she would breathe out real hard, she would sink. And one of the things that she would do as a practice is jump into the pool, breathe out real hard, and lay flat on the bottom of the pool at the 10-foot end, and do that for like 30 seconds. And I'm sitting there watching that, realizing there's no air in her lungs, the possibility she could pass out, in which case she would never float to the surface. Without rescue, it would be game over. To watch this 13-year-old girl perform this bragging operation struck me as an awful dangerous procedure. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Gee, that's scary. I would hate to be her father, because I wouldn't be able to sleep at night knowing that she pulled stunts like that. There are books, I think about six volumes now, books that are called Darwin Awards. For people who do things that they shouldn't do and end up not continuing their genetics to the next generation. And I don't know. I mean, I understand the bravado, and she's only a kid, so what does she know of danger? But, geez, that strikes me as really dangerous type of behavior.
I agree, and I sort of had nightmares over that one. I hope she didn't continue doing it as they move to the new house.
People do all kinds of very strange things. I used to watch do-it-yourself cable channels where guys would knock down walls that had gas lines that hadn't been turned off and just bang into them with this big mallet, and just you were just sort of waiting for the explosion to come. People do all kinds of dangerous things. Fortunately, they tend to get away with a lot of them. You got to kind of be real aggressive in doing stupid, dangerous things before it usually catches up with you. Okay, on to the next. Sorry, Hollywood. Science ruin another entertaining bit of science fiction. Although modern renditions of our seemingly favorite dinosaur, Tyrannosaurus Rex, always shows them with a something more, fearsome teeth, and flapping tongue, new research suggests that T-Rex couldn't move its tongue at all. Most dinosaurs, in fact, may have had tongues that were rooted to the floor of their mouths. Researchers at the University of Texas at Austin and the Chinese Academy of Sciences examined more than 330 fossil specimens, including small bird-like dinosaurs, large plant-eating dinosaurs, flying pterosaurs, and Tyrannosaurus rex. More specifically, the scientists studied the dinosaur's delicate hyoid bone, which anchors the tongue to the mouth. Let me drop. The team then used dissection and high-resolution images to examine the hyoid muscle and bones of 15 modern animals related to dinosaurs, among them three alligators, a myriad of bird species ranging from ostriches to ducks, according to a statement issued by the University of Texas at Austin. Researchers compared the dinosaur hyoid to those of modern specimens and published their findings in the journal PLOS-1. Most of the dinosaurs the team studied had short and simple hyoids, similar to those of alligators and crocodiles. Alligators and crocs have a tear-and-gulp approach to eating their food. They don't chew much, and therefore they don't need a particularly long or mobile tongue. The tongues of T-Rex and other dinosaurs were likely similarly short and simple. Let me drop. Birds, by contrast, have very diverse and complex tongues. The way that their tongues are able to protrude so far is that these little skinny bones are super, super long. They're so long that in a hummingbird, they wrap over the surface of the skull into the nose hole. The researchers found that bird-like dinosaurs and pterosaurs, which remember aren't dinosaurs, but they're prehistoric reptiles, also had complicated tongue bones, which led them to posit that the evolution of diversity and mobility in tongues might be connected to flight. When ancient creatures' hands evolved into wings, they needed mobile tongues so that they could better manipulate their food. Flight may also have allowed dinosaurs to access different kinds of food, which required specialized tongues and mouths. Let me drop. But flight may not have been the only factor influencing the mobility of dinosaurs' tongues. Ornithischians, an herbivorous group of dinosaurs that include triceratops, also had complex hyoids, perhaps because they needed to chew their food more than dinosaurs like the T-Rex. Let me drop for possible comments.
Why are you talking about the prehistoric age? Do you know on the walls of caves, with a cave in life, is there any proof or whatever of any kind of organized religion they might have had?
I'm a little bit confused what the question is, because, you know, dinosaurs were millions and millions of years ago, and human civilization history kind of really took up about 5,000 years ago. So you're talking about human beings and whether they had religion. As far as I understand, the cave paintings were of animals and people's hands. They spit out charcoal, and they spit out red iron filings and such that they had in the earth. You can infer religion since they didn't write anything down, and all the oral histories have faded away. You have to go to Sumeria, you have to go to Mesopotamia, you have to go to Egypt to find the first recorded history of civilization, and with it, religion.
Okay, boy. And so we go. Will you answer my question? Fine.
Okay, very good. Any other comments before I move on to the next one? Despite decades of research, scientists have made little progress in halting Alzheimer's disease, a form of dementia. But researchers may have recently discovered a potential breakthrough. The New York Times reported that two studies show a relationship between two types of herpes virus and the development of Alzheimer's. The relationship was first found during a study commissioned by the National Institute of Health. The research team created computer models that mapped the genes that were disrupted or activated during the progression of Alzheimer's. They found that many of the genes that clicked on during Alzheimer's are the same genes that activate when the body is fighting a virus. Researchers then looked at DNA and RNA sequences collected from 622 brains afflicted with Alzheimer's and 322 disease-free brains, finding that two herpes viruses were more common in brains of people who died of Alzheimer's. People with more severe cases of the disease showed more signs of the virus. Those herpes strains, which cause a mild childhood disease called roseola, are found in 90% of children in the United States and usually go dormant in childhood, but can be reactivated in times of illness or stress. The research appeared in the journal Neurons. Let me drop. The study is by no means conclusive evidence that viruses cause Alzheimer's, but it is possible that viruses worsen the disease's symptoms. As the disease progresses, the virus may come out of dormancy, eliciting an immune reaction and leading to the formation of the brain plaque seen in Alzheimer's patients. The study suggests that these viruses are probably significant players in driving the immune system in Alzheimer's. In a second unpublished study that will soon appear in Neuron, researchers exposed mouse and brain cells to the implicated herpes viruses. The exposure led to a reaction in which protein fibers called amyloid, which caused the plaques found in Alzheimer's patients' brains, were formed, perhaps to ensnare the virus as part of an immune response. The researchers proposed that the activated viruses cause a buildup in amyloid plaques, which then trigger the Alzheimer's. Let me drop. Well, the study is impressive. These herpes viruses could be unrelated to Alzheimer's. Researchers have been down this road before. There have been many speculations and even outright claims that infections contribute to the development of Alzheimer's disease, but none of them has held up after rigorous cause-effect evaluation. Whatever the case, the new studies make the once controversial idea that that a virus is involved in Alzheimer's another reasonable avenue of study. That's unlikely to be the story. A lot of genetic factors are also at play in this disease, and it will take more studies to untangle how immune reactions, genetic, and other factors play into this progression. Let me drop for possible comment.
Out of curiosity, Roy, are any of these studies about Alzheimer's and other kinds of dementia failure, are the studies saying that it can be diet-related? There are a number of physicians on PBS indicating that you can create a lot of increased probability of brain health if you eat certain foods and avoid certain foods. To your knowledge, has that been confirmed? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
I wish I could say yes, but the answer is it's very dubious. There's not a lot of research that would indicate any of this. A lot of times these studies kind of give you something in the middle, open to too much interpretation, and there are people who are very optimistic and go with that interpretation. But as far as I'm aware, I mean, unfortunately, we actually do significant research into the beneficial effects of multivitamins. There are an almost non-existent list of studies that definitively prove the benefit other than in cases of people who are malnourished to begin with. So you have taking food supplements for prostates. You have others taking them for brain. You have others taking them for their eyes. They might help. They might not. They have no risk, perhaps, and they don't cost that much. And so medical science kind of suggests people kind of take this opportunity, and it's sort of like the atheist in the foxhole. What do you conclude?
In past decades, our population had a lot more sun exposure, therefore we were getting vitamin D. My impression is that to build up calcium in the bones, vitamin D is also required. We spend a lot of time indoors these days, And almost anybody who has a blood test, a significant percentage of the population is now coming up vitamin D deficient. I'd like to believe that people who take vitamin D supplement pills are correcting this, although since the dawn, many of the studies of vitamins, other than people that are malnutritions, the vitamins seem to do almost nothing. I wonder if it's also true of vitamin D from what you know. And I think vitamin D could very well be associated with Alzheimer's, the lack of it. Oh, you're right, KQIW.
Well, there's a surprising amount of vitamins and minerals that are added to everyday food products. Cereals are fortified with vitamins. Milk obviously has vitamin D. Salt has iodine. It's all over the place. The problem, there's a whole bunch of problems with food supplements, and one of them is that there's no organization that's testing the purity and the legitimate amounts that are listed on the label. You know, it's just as long as it doesn't kill anyone, everyone has other things to do with their budget. And a lot of these food supplements are not even grown and made in the United States. It's my understanding that a lot of it is imported in places like China. And if you recall what they did with baby formula, that causes me a wee bit of concern when I take my multivitamin.
You said when you take your multivitamin, in other words, you're doing it as belt and suspenders. You're not sure you need it, but you think it's not going to hurt, therefore you take vitamin. Are you suggesting you do take multivitamins, Roy? Go ahead.
Yeah, again, it's like the atheist in the foxhole. You pray because if there's no one, you didn't really waste that much time, and if there's someone out there who's going to fix things for you, then you're better off. Multivitamins are safe, and they're relatively inexpensive. I recall many years ago, I heard a interview with a top researcher. I think it was Harvard Medical School. He had no particular proof, and the interviewer asked whether he took multivitamins, and he actually was honest enough to say yes, he did. Basically, his mother gave it to him when he was growing up, and so he just continued to do it into adulthood. So I feel like suspenders. It's, you know, if unfortunately I find that there's a risk, I'll have to reconsider that. But until there's a risk, I'm not, you know, there's an old saying that people who take a lot of vitamins have the most expensive urine in the world.
WS2N.
Paul.
Many years ago, maybe 30 years ago, I don't know how many years, but on 60 Minutes, they had a show, and they had this couple, and they were taking vitamins, and they had big bowls of it on the counter, and they were taking like 500 pills a day or something like that, all kinds of vitamins and pills, and they were doing this for years, they said, and I tried to find out going on the internet. Now this story was before the internet, so I can't find out what happened to these people. But could you imagine, like, taking 500 pills a day? You know, they said it's all safe. You know, you could buy this in the store. But I can't imagine that these people are still alive today. But maybe they are. Maybe they're healthy. Back to you, Roy.
You know, there's an old saying, you can always have too much of a good thing. And that goes 5,000 times with vitamins. Vitamins have problems. Even water. You know, you need water to live. And yet, I could take someone and force enough water into their system where I could shut down their kidneys and they'd die from it. So you can die from overdosing on water. So if you can do that with water, you can imagine what disasters vitamins allow. Oil-based vitamins, A and D, are not easily excreted. They collect in people's bodies and cause a lot of problems. The water-soluble vitamins, the Bs, the Cs, can get pushed out, but sometimes they could crystallize in people's bladder and give them kidney stones, so that's a problem. Or they can mess up electrolyte balances and give people severe changes in their bowel habits. So there's a whole bunch of ways to screw things up. I mean, I remember I actually saw one Nobel Prize laureate. That was Linus Pauling, who had won a Nobel Prize in chemistry and I think another one in peace. And unfortunately, he was pushing multivitamin C. You know, his idea was to take grams, you know, 10, 20 grams a day, and if he felt a sniffle coming on, he would increase even that. That's kind of dangerous. If you have any predilection to kidney stones, that's just asking for trouble. So too much of a good thing is a bad thing. Any other comments, or I'll move on to the next.
You over, right?
Again?
It wasn't Linus Pauling, vitamin C.
Linus Pauling was vitamin C. C is in Charlie. Okay, on to the next. The study published in Nature Geoscience may help explain variations in Venus's rotation seen by different spacecraft over the years. Venus spins at a leisurely pace, taking an average of 243 Earth days to complete one full rotation. Although its atmosphere only requires 4 to 5 days to complete its full rotation. Measurements taken 16 Earth years apart by the Magellan and Venus Express missions differ by up to 7 minutes. Scientists have found it difficult to measure Venus's rotation rate because it's so slow, but they have analyzed the displacement over long periods of time to get an estimate. This is also hard to study because it's shrouded in a thick cloud of sulfuric acid, and no one quite knows why the atmosphere is rotating at such a rapid rate, so different than the planet itself. Let me drop. But not all the atmosphere appears to be super-rotating. Recently, the Japanese Akatsuki mission detected a massive 10,000-kilometer-long bow-shaped wave that extended 65 kilometers into the atmosphere over the Aphrodite Terra region, an elevated plateau about the size of Africa at the planet's equator. This wave is not moving with a super-rotating atmosphere, but instead, it seems to be moving with the surface. Scientists wanted to find out whether the wave, which is produced by the upward flow of wind, hitting the mountains could affect the planet's spin. Their models of atmospheric conditions and topography on Venus showed the wave appeared during the afternoon, the equivalent of about 30 Earth days, and disappeared by dusk. Let me drop. They estimated the mountain waves could speed up the rate of rotation at the planet's surface by 2 minutes per solar day. Some of the angular momentum transferred to the solid body is going to speed up the planet, whereas the atmosphere is going to slow down. Just to confuse things a bit more, these waves are termed gravity waves, which are not the same as gravitational waves, nor are they the same as waves of gravity. These are atmospheric gravity waves, not unlike a stationary ripple above a rock in a flowing stream. They are waves of atmospheric gas produced by gravitational effects of the planet. Fluctuations in the length of the day are not unique to Venus. They also happen here on Earth. The motions of the atmosphere, oceans, and ice constantly cause millisecond shifts in our 24-hour solar day. Let me drop for possible comments. Okay, on to the next. Some theoreticians are more pessimistic than others, I guess. The Fermi paradox remains a stumbling block when it comes to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Named in honor of the famed physicist Enrico Fermi, who first proposed it, this paradox addresses the apparent disparity between the expected probability that intelligent life is plentiful in the universe and the apparent lack of evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence. In the decades since Enrico Fermi first posed the question that encapsulated this paradox, where is everybody? Scientists have attempted to explain this disparity one way or another. But in a new study conducted by three famed scholars from the Future Humanity Institute of Oxford University, the paradox is reevaluated in such a way that it makes it seem likely that humanity is alone in this observable universe. Let me drop. The study, titled Dissolving the Fermi Paradox, recently appeared online. The study was jointly conducted by Anders Sandberg, a research fellow at the Future of Humanity Institute, Anna Martin, senior fellow at Oxford University, Eric Drexler, the famed engineer who popularized the concept of nanotechnology, and Ton Ord, the famous Australian moral philosopher at Oxford University. This equation states that the number of civilizations in our galaxy that we might be able to communicate can be determined by multiplying the average rate of star formations in our galaxy, the fraction of those stars which have planets, the number of planets that actually support life, the number of planets that will develop life, the number of planets that will develop intelligent life, the number of civilizations that would develop transmission technologies, and the length of time that these civilizations would have to transmit their signals into space. Let me drop. As such, Sandberg, Drexler, and Ord looked at the equation's parameters as uncertainty ranges, rather instead of focusing on what values they might have had. They looked at what the largest and smallest values they could have based on current knowledge, whereas some values have become well-constrained, such as the number of planets in our galaxy based on exoplanet studies and the number that exists within a star's habitable zone, others remain far more uncertain. When they combined these uncertainties, rather than the guesswork that often goes into the Fermi paradox, the team got a distribution as a result. Naturally, this resulted in a broad spread due to the number of certainties involved. But as Dr. Sandberg explained, it did provide them with an estimate of the likelihood that humanity, given what we know, is alone in the galaxy. Let me drop. In the end, the team's conclusions do not mean that humanity is alone in this universe, or that the odds of finding evidence of extraterrestrial civilizations, both past and present, is unlikely. Instead, it simply means that we can say with greater confidence, based on what we know, that humanity is most likely the only intelligent species in the Milky Way galaxy at present. And of course, this all comes down to the uncertainties we currently have to contend with when it comes to SETI and the Drake equation. In that respect, the study conducted by Sandberg, Drexler, and Ord is an indication that much more needs to be learned before we can attempt to determine just how likely ET is out there. Let me drop for possible comments. Okay, on to the next. For decades, scientists have been able to measure this glow, the glow of microwave light dubbed the anomalous microwave emission, coming from a number of regions in the night sky, but have yet to identify its exact source. In a study led by researchers at Cardiff University and published in the journal Nature Astronomy, an international team has shown that it is likely that microwaves are coming from tiny crystals of carbon, otherwise known as nanodiamonds, inside of dust and gas that surrounds newly formed stars. This collection of dust and gas, known as protoplanetary disks, is where planets begin to form and contain a whole host of organic molecules. The extremely hot and energized conditions within these disks are ideal for nanodiamonds to form. These nanodiamonds within protoplanetary disks are hundreds of thousands of times smaller than a grain of sand and are often found in meteorites that land on Earth. Let me drop. To arrive at their results, the team honed in on three young stars that were emitting anomalous microwave emission light using the Robert C. Byrne Green Bank telescopes in West Virginia and the Australia Telescope Compact Array. By studying the infrared light that was coming from the protoplanetary disks surrounding the stars, the team was able to match this with the unique signature that is naturally given off by nanodiamonds. Let me drop for possible comments.
WA2VDH for the comment.
Sure, VDH.
I was wondering, does the diamond naturally have a resonant or an emission frequency in the microwave range? And did they mention what frequencies in the microwave range this was? Go ahead.
I assume from the article that I read that there is a characteristic spectrum for nanodiamonds. That spectroscopic emission for carbon that is in a crystalline diamond-like configuration. After this little presentation, you could just go to ac2gs.com, and I have a link to the article that I can't recall other links. The problem with a lot of these studies is eventually, if you use all the links back to the original article, there's a paywall involved, and you know, some of those paywalls can get rather expensive.
Okay, fine business. Also, I wonder if I could just comment on the previous comment you made about Venus and its rotation.
Yeah, sure. Comment away.
I think you mentioned that the planet Venus, it rotates, I think it was something like 243 days. How does that compare with the with its yearly cycle around the sun? Is that related? Is there some kind of tidal locking there? Usually a planet that far away from its primary usually wouldn't be tidally locked or anything like that, would it?
I don't think it's tidally locked. As far as I'm aware, there's no planet that's truly tidally locked in the solar system. I think its year is significantly shorter than its day.
Okay, yeah, because I think some kind of resonance occurs with the planet Mercury, where it's a 3-2 ratio or something, if I'm recalling. I'm not sure, but I think there is something that happens with Mercury. But I don't think it's with Venus, so I think it's too far out. Anyway, fine business. Thanks.
Very good. Yes, I remember reading that Mercury is... They have a strange expression for it, because it's not tidally locked the way that we think of tidally locked things. But it seems to have locked into a 2-3 a ratio. And so, unfortunately, there's no good term for that available. So some people get it confused with tidally locked bodies in space. But that's it for Venus and such. Any other questions or comments before I move on to yet the next one?
The rotation rate of Venus is so slow. I think I remember reading that its rotation rate and its orbital period are such that even though it's turning counterclockwise, what we call top view, that the sun literally would rise in the west and set in the east on Venus. I may have that wrong. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yeah, I think also it's very strange in that the planet rotation isn't going in the same direction as the rotation around the sun. So it's a very strange ball of sulfur acid, sulfuric acid.
It has a ridiculously high temperature, 800 some odd degrees Fahrenheit, and I believe it's also got an extremely thick atmosphere with something like 150 times Earth pressure at the surface, K2IW.
Yeah, definitely not a place you want to go for a summer vacation. Okay, on to the next. Scientists at MIT and elsewhere have analyzed data from K2, the mission to NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, and have discovered a trove of possible exoplanets among some 50,000 stars. In a paper that appeared in the Astronomical Journal, the scientists report that the discovery of nearly 80 new planetary candidates, including a particular standout, a likely planet that orbits a star designated HD73344, which could be the brightest planet host ever discovered by two missions. The planet appears to orbit HD73344 every 15 days, and based on the amount of light that it blocks each time it passes in front of its star, scientists estimate that the planet is 2.5 times the size of Earth and 10 times as massive. It also, very likely, is incredibly hot, with temperatures somewhere in the range of 1,200 to 1,300 degrees Celsius, or 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, about the temperature of lava from an erupting volcano. Let me drop. The planet lies at a relatively close distance of 35 parsecs, or about 114 light-years from Earth. Given its proximity and the fact that it orbits a very bright star, scientists believe that the planet is an ideal candidate for follow-up studies to determine its atmospheric composition and other characteristics. Scientists believe that it would probably be more like a smaller, hotter version of Uranus or Neptune. The team analyzed data from K2's 16th and 17th observing campaign, known as C16 and C17. During each campaign, K2 observes one patch of the sky for 80 days. The telescope is on an orbit that trails the Earth as it travels around the Sun. For most other campaigns, K2 has been in rear-facing orientation, in which the telescope observes those stars that are essentially in its rear-view mirror. Let me drop. Since the telescope travels behind the Earth, those stars that it observes are typically not observable by scientists until the planet circles back around the Sun to that particular patch of sky nearly a year later. Thus, for rear-facing campaigns, there have been little motivation to analyze K2 data quickly. The C16 and C17 campaigns, on the other hand, were forward-facing. K2 observed those stars that were in the front of the telescope and within Earth's field of view, at least for the next several months. During C16, K2 observed 20,647 stars over a period of 80 days between December 7, 2017 and February 25, 2018. On February 28, the mission released the data in the form of pixel-level images to the astronomy community. Let me drop. Since the team released its results, astronomers have validated four of the candidates as definite exoplanets. They have been observing other candidates that the study identified, including the possible planet orbiting the mentioned HD7334. Let me drop for possible comments.
The vast majority of the exoplanets that have been discovered to date by Kepler and a few other missions are done by the planet passing in front of the star. And the light output of the star dips down during that period of time, and that gives you a lot of information, periodicity, magnitudes, and so on. However, it takes a rather precise alignment that, from our point of view, the planet passes directly in front of the star. There's only 1 or 2 degrees of tilt where that can take place. If you tilted the Earth's planet, Earth's orbit around the Sun, more than 2 degrees, somebody sitting on Alpha Centauri would not see that occultation. So that suggests that only 1 or 2% of the exoplanets we are really seeing. There might be 99% more of them, so to speak, the ones that we don't see because we don't get that favorable alignment. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
I agree, Dick. These are fortuitous findings on our part, as most of astronomy tends to be. All those lovely little pulsars and quasars out there require us to be in a particular position to those generators. At right angles to them, it looks like nothing to people in other parts of space. So most astronomy, unfortunately, you have to be lucky for. And that's the case for the exoplanets as well. If you're not in line and able to see the disturbance of the star as a planet goes around it, in your view, you miss it entirely.
Because of this favorable alignment requirement, that suggests that for the stars we have studied to date that have exoplanets, the total number is 98 times greater than that, so to speak. When you add that to the mixture of probability of finding life and or intelligent life, that makes the situation look a hell of a lot more desirable. During the time that Drake wrote his equation, way back in the 70s, I think it was, we used to think that only one star per million had planets. We now realize every star has some number of planets. So our life estimations have gone up by 1 million to 1 from that factor, And now from this factor, they go up by almost another 100 to 1. Over to you, Roy. K2IW.
NWS2N.
Yes, Paul.
It might be helpful for people to understand the difference between the regular Kepler mission and the K2. What do you think, Roy?
Yeah, sure. Give it a stroll.
Yeah, what Roy is talking about, the earliest part of the mission of Kepler, the whole design of it was to follow Earth in our orbit around the sun, but it kept staring at one place, looking at Cygnus, the location of Cygnus, just one particular spot in the sky. And I think it was like less than a half a degree of arc that it was looking at. Very small, like less than what you would look at if you were staring at the moon. And it just stayed there for years, and it would look at, or a couple of years, and it would stare at 150 to 200,000 stars at one location. And that's what was doing, that's what they did all the evaluations with. When Kepler started going on the fritz and losing its control because the momentum wheels were quitting, then the engineers got the idea, let's try something else. Let's try balancing the spacecraft on the solar wind that's coming out of the sun, and we'll help. We'll use that as a way of keeping Kepler straight, but we won't be able to point the Cygnus anymore. So they just left it facing out away from the sun, and as they would go around, they would look at all the different stars, from one year to the next. So the mission changed. So because of that, they called it K2. And that's how they got that. They went from Kepler to K2. Back to you, Roy.
And the total number of discoveries in K2 versus K1, isn't that fairly similar, Paul? Go ahead.
It's similar, but it just shows that looking at one spot, they found, I think it's something like almost 3,000 stars. Where this system is finding less stars, it's not staring at one place, so, they can stare at one location, I believe it's 70 days, and then, in fact, I think Roy said that, and then they have to move on, because it's moving around the sun, and it has to find a new part of the sky to look at. But next year it comes back, and it'll look at the same stars again, but it's looking out at the ecliptic. Again, you're not looking up north, or you're not looking down south. Back to your work.
And what are they moving in order to give orientation with solar wind? An inertial wheel is still working, so they get orientation in one axis. But the other axis, are they moving a solar panel or something like that to use the solar wind to do orientation? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Not sure of the technology involved. I assume Paul knows more about this.
Yeah, if you had a soda can and you just had flat panels attached to it, nothing sticking out, no solar wing type of thing, just a couple of flat panels lining the outside of a can. That's really what Kepler looks like. So they took that, at some point it comes to a V. Where these flat panels are located along the can, the run of the can, they face that toward the sun, and then the solar wind would hit it in such a way that it was kind of like balancing a little buoyant boat, like a wooden boat. You put it into a sink and try to balance it. It was that type of thing, and that became like. In place of the broken wheels. They had four wheels, one was a backup, two failed, and they needed something else. So this was their way of counteracting the problem. They couldn't keep it very steady, so they gave up with the idea of looking at Cygnus for, year in, year out. But it had done its job over there anyway. They spent a couple of years looking at that one location. So this was an extended mission that paid off. Back to you, Roy.
2NBR for Paul.
Escortel. Paul, what do you have to say?
Paul, this is N2NBR, John in Northern Westchester. Did you run across in your space exposure there to the ideology of using centrifugal force to produce artificial gravity? In other words, a big Ferris wheel turning horizontally at enough speed to equate your body weight. Back to you, Paul. Well, we talked about that a little earlier. I don't want to take away the time from Roy. He's still got a couple of things to do. But, you know, that's been discussed for decades. Different wheels and different ways of doing things. They've tried a couple of actual experiments in space. But we can cover that later. And we talked a little bit about that earlier in the net, but not much. Stand by, and we can cover that later. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, thank you, Paul. We kind of glossed on that with talking about 2001 A Space Odyssey. One of the features of that spaceship was that it rotated and produced a fake gravity using centripetal forces and such. So I think I've done enough for tonight. I'll save a few more for next week, and I'm sure there'll be a whole bunch of new things in the news. Once again, if you're interested in either proposing a topic, ask a question, make a comment, suggest something, mailbag at ac2gs.com, mailbag at alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. And I just kind of lit up the my website, roy.ac2gs.com, with links to all of these subjects, to the book that I mentioned earlier, and to the YouTube, that if you don't really care about the science behind it, they're rather pretty pictures. So this is Roy, AC2GS. Thank you very much for participating, and we'll do it again next week.
I thank you, Roy. Good stuff. Paul, WS2N, you got it.
Yeah, it was very good. Very good presentation, Roy. I had maybe half a dozen different topics to go through. But I just wanted to comment first that I know you were asking about field day. I did not make it to Limehouse, but I did have somewhere I had to go today. Fortunately, I didn't get there. But I had time to operate at home, so I made a lot of contacts, a couple of pages worth, using, from home. So that was one Delta NLI, so one D for working at home. But we'll try again next year. There's an astronaut, Nick Nager, that's his name, young guy. He's going to fly to the International Space Station at the end of this year in October. He's the first one out of this new class, class from astronauts from 2013. There's another group that just came in 2017, but he's the first out of this group. So 2017 hasn't flown at all, and this guy, 2013, is the first of his group, and he'll be going up in October. But again, he's just going to be going with the Russian cosmonaut that's going to be flying the Soyuz spacecraft. So it's just going to be the two of them. It's kind of strange. I'm still trying to figure out what happened there. I have a pretty good idea, but I'm not sure, because the flight after that will be, they'll be back to three astronauts again. So again, for a short period of time, we're going to have five people on the space station instead of six. Six is the normal number. They'll drop down to three, and then they'll send up three more. They did this a couple of years ago because the Russians did not have enough work, for the two Russians. The science that they were doing was being curtailed because they were eventually at one point going to send up another science module to the space station, and it got delayed, all kinds of problems and leaks, and then hydrazine rocket system, and they just delayed it year after year. It's 12 years now. So because of that, they said, well, we're going to cut back. We're just going to send the commander up, and if NASA wants to keep sending people up, they'll continue to pay. So we were only going to pay for one guy. That's it, to go up. That's $70 million. And we did that just that one time. And then what happened was Boeing settled a lawsuit with Russia. They had a big lawsuit about some complicated scheme. They used to launch rockets from the equator on something called Sea Launch. They used to float this big barge out to the middle of the ocean in the Pacific, right near the equator. And three people were involved, Boeing, Norway, I believe it was, and Russia, and the Ukraine. And they had all kinds of problems. And they broke up this alliance. Boeing sued Russia and wound up with $300 million finally over the years. They turned around and gave it to NASA. And they said, here, take this money and buy more seats. So that's what's been happening for the last couple of years. Any flight that goes up now has three people in the Soyuz spacecraft. But now for some reason they cut back on two. So maybe they ran out of money. I'll have to find out what happened. That's probably what happened. But then something else must have kicked in afterwards, because now all of a sudden we're going to have three again after that. So there's a bit of a mystery there that I'll have to eventually solve. Let me drop it. Okay, I was talking about another module that's going to be going to the space station eventually. The Russians plan on having a another module dock with the space station in April of next year. And this thing is called the, what was it? It was the USLO module. I don't know. They have letters for it. It's the UM module. It's essentially a docking berthing module that Russia is going to be sending up. And they plan on docking it with the Russian part of the space station and leaving it there. And when the end of the International Space Station eventually comes, it'll be 2024, 2028, Russia plans on taking this module that they're going to send up and start their own space station called OPSEC, O-P-S-E-K. And it's an acronym in Russia, but it's basically going to be another Mir type space station that's much bigger. So at that point in 2024, 2028, at the end of the ISS, when NASA is trying to decide what we're going to do with it, are we going to turn it over to a commercial operation, or are we going to deorbit it, or what's going to happen? Russia's got a plan on taking this module and a couple of the other modules, and maybe another one that they will send up before that time frame, and actually separated from the space station, and then eventually send up more modules to dock with this UM module, this birthing docking module, which it's a big module with six ports on it. You know, every base of it has a docking port, and they'll build out from that. So that's yet to be launched. It's going to launch on a proton rocket next April, and I'll see how they do with that, and then find out if they ever decide to send up this other module, the Nokia module they called it, which was going to dock with the space station. It was a big science module. It had another bathroom in it, and whether or not they get that off the ground or not, probably the next year. So I thought that was interesting. It's the Orbital Piloted Assembly and Experiment Complex. That's going to be the name of there. I'm going to call it like Mir 2. So the interesting thing about this thing, they plan on changing the inclination. I can't imagine how they're going to change the inclination from where they are now. Right now they're at 51.6 degrees on the ISS. you know, if you look at your globe and you look up from the equator, it's 51.6 degrees. You know, you go around that orbit, that's where the ISS is right now. They plan on changing the inclination to 70 degrees, 70, so quite high. And that's where they're going to have their new space station. They always wanted to do that. After Mir 1, they planned on actually having a Mir 2.